It's 4:36 on a Friday downtown. Rich Kimble here with you on the Pulse, WZON. Our next guest on the show has carved out a remarkable career in films like Risky Business, Revenge of the Nerds, Ray, television shows from Moonlighting to New Girl, American Dad, Supernatural, and a brand new series on Amazon called Heiston. Curtis Armstrong joins us on the phone this afternoon. Curtis, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me along. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. I had a chance to watch the pilot episode of Heiston earlier this week, and it's just a terrific show. What drew you to this project, and in particular, the character of Uncle Billy?
Well, it was one of those things where I had gotten the call that they wanted me to do it, which was a surprise. And I read the script and had the same response to it I think you did, which was that it was just so delightful and so funny and so odd. It's a very odd show. And there is just a quality to it, apart from the humor, that I found, particularly in this day and age, kind of appealing. It was a humane quality that was not, I'm not suggesting that it's sappy or anything. It's a genuine, humane form of humor, which I find very, very attractive. So, and as far as the part goes, I could tell by the writing that was on the script that it was going to be something that required a different approach than I usually take to parts, because I tend to be, you know, on the large side. I tend to be sort of theatrical in my approach, if you look at, you know, stuff like Metatron and things like that. This required really trusting the actual words and going against my instincts and playing very little, and letting the words play. And so it was a different approach and a really interesting one for me, because I don't usually work that way.
Well, you got some great words, written by Bob Nelson, directed by Jonathan Dayton, Valerie Faris, and a wonderful cast, including Chris Parnell, the terrific young man, Lewis Pullman, who plays...
I'll tell you, I think Lewis is an enormous talent. He's got such... I mean, enormous charm, a great instinctive sense to comedy, and he has this purity about him, I mean, in his delivery. The thing that struck me watching it when it was finally done, it didn't really strike me that much when we were working on it, but when I actually saw him on camera, was he has this sort of almost like a silent film comedian quality to him. Like a Buster Keaton or you know, Harry Langdon or one of those people, Stan Laurel even, that there's a gentle, you know, calmness to him even when he's being extremely funny. It comes from the heart, and I find that really appealing too.
For those who haven't seen it yet, and it's available for free right now during pilot season on Amazon.com, we're talking about Heiston with Curtis Armstrong. Can you explain the premise of the show?
Well, you know, I can do that. It doesn't really do it credit, but essentially it is this young man, Heiston, who's 19, and he lives with his parents, his brother and sister, and his uncle Billy, and he has... imaginary friends is the only way you can put it. They are friends that he sees and communicates with, but his family does not see. So his family assume he's crazy. The family themselves have their own set of problems and really should be sort of looking to themselves first, but they're concerned and they think he maybe needs to be institutionalized. His imaginary friends in the pilot are Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers and Shaquille O'Neal.
Like
and
you do.
The two of them spend all of their time with him, giving him advice, much of it bad, But they're gentle, nice people who really understand in a way that the rest of the world doesn't. So the whole question in that pilot is, does he wind up institutionalized, or is he allowed to continue functioning outside, where he's actually functioning very well? Yeah, unless you know that he sees famous people all the time. So that's the general idea of the story. But when the show comes back, assuming it does come back for a full series, these imaginary friends will be changing every week. Well, and whichever people come in to be imaginary friends will be part of what, guides the show.
Well, I just loved it. It's wonderful. It's funny. It's sweet. It's tender. And I sure hope it comes back for more. Curtis, did want to talk about your career as well. Your IMDb listing, I think it's got more pages than my mortgage. With James Brown dead, are you the hardest working guy in show business now?
Well, no, but I wouldn't say that. But I am very fortunate in working a lot. And right now, this year has been terrific because it's been between Supernatural and New Girl and Heiston and American Dad. I'm working actually on another project right now, which I'm not allowed to discuss at this point. But it's been a busy year and been a busy few years. Up until this year, we were doing King of the Nerds as well every summer, which was unfortunately just canceled by TBS. But everything else has been going really splendidly. So I'm one of those very fortunate actors who has a lot of work at this point.
Well, of course, we would have to talk about Revenge of the Nerds, which has had a remarkable shelf life for all these years. What is it that has kept that film and the sequel so popular? Is it because, like me and all of us, there's a little nerd in all of us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing with Revenge of the Nerds, even though it's a hard R, that movie. there's quite a lot of inappropriate material in it, but what winds up happening is, by the end of the movie, there is, once again, I mean, I hate to sort of bring this up over and over again, but there's a genuineness, the fact that Lewis and Gilbert stand up in front of everybody and essentially come out as nerds at a time when that wasn't considered popular, and welcoming all of these people of all races and colors and sexual orientations and genders, all welcoming them all to them to be under their banner. It's still a very touching moment in that movie for me. And when Robert Carradine and I created King of the Nerds for television, the one thing that I emphasized repeatedly for people was, when we were working with other companies to produce that show, was if they ever had a doubt about what the tone of the show should be, they should just go back to Revenge of the Nerds and watch that pep rally scene, because that's exactly the kind of tone that we wanted for King of the Nerds, and I'm happy to say we got it. But I think that's partially the reason, the idea of the absolute acceptance of people. I mean, you can make a lot more into this than is probably a good idea, but what's happening in our country right now with the attitude of people towards immigrants, it's the opposite of that. It's accepting people without question and working with people and living with people who are very different from you for the better, the better of everyone. So I think that's the reason that Revenge of the Nerds, aside from being a funny movie and aside from having ridiculous, stupid stuff, belching contests and nose picking and all that stuff, which isn't exactly Noel Coward, you still have this other message, which is a great message.
And so many of your characters, Bert Viola and Moonlighting, Booger to a certain degree, and definitely Uncle Billy, have a vulnerability to them as well that I think that just makes them much more interesting characters that people can identify with.
Well, I think so, too. I mean, you know, I get a sense, I've been saying that Uncle Billy is sort of a cross between between Booger and Hunter S. Thompson, which I think is a fairly accurate summary. But he's somebody who does have that quality. Now, you know, Booger did not exactly have that. He got it eventually. But Booger was also the one of all the nerds who, when their house had been trashed, he suggested that they go burn down their house. So he wasn't terribly accepting, necessarily, until the very end of the movie. That's who Booger was. But I do see a lot of him in Uncle Billy with that overlayer of acceptance and tolerance, which is something that everybody, you know, likes to try to strive for.
We're talking with Curtis Armstrong, and before we let you go, I have to bring up a fact that on the show we've talked to Mickey Dolenz, Jimmy Webb, Van Dyke Parks, biographer Alan Shipton, and all with the purpose of learning more about one of my heroes, and I know somebody you love as well, Harry Nilsson. What made you fan of Nilsson?
I hadn't realized you'd talked to Alan Shipton about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's he's one of those people who is not known anywhere near as well as he should be. His gifts were astonishing. He was very generous with his gifts, and as a songwriter and as a singer, he was hugely important to me from the time I first heard him in about 1968. It's funny, too, because I realized in retrospect that between 1968, 1970, and 71, some of my favorite songs were Nilsson songs that I heard on the radio. I had no idea it was the same person. I mean, how you could have one person do Everybody's Talking and Jump into the Fire and Me and My Arrow and Without You, or Without Her, for that matter, and all these songs which are so different. It sounds like they're being performed by groups, and it sounds like they're being, you know, they're all different people. And then when I realized, my God, it's the same guy, that meant that I had to go into it. And then discovering that the Beatles, who were my lifelong idols, considered him their favorite, not only their favorite American band, their favorite American singer, but their favorite American group, because he sounded so huge and fascinating. He also had a great sense of humor, very intelligent. I never met him, but I sure wish I had.
And you continue to lead the fight to get him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That it didn't happen this year, but the battle continues.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, for exactly that reason, has long had sort of a checkered reputation, because there are a lot of people who should be in the Hall of Fame that are not. I mean, even when you get down to someone like Paul McCartney, who is in there now, but it was sort of appalling how long it took them to finally get around to putting him in. So you do have to question sometimes where their priorities are. And I would love to see him in it, because I think he deserves to be in it. But by the same token, there are so many people who love his music, and I value it so much. If he gets into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter that much. He gave us an enormous body of work, and you know, I'm very grateful.
Curtis Armstrong, we're a big fan of your work for many, many years. Love the new show, Heiston. We wish you much success with that and continued success in your career, and thanks so much for making some time for us this afternoon.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Curtis Armstrong on Downtown 10 Minutes.